AK-47.
What'd you got it out tonight?
They don't let us march in the streets anymore, so gotta practice some of our rights.
You feel like you'll need to use it?
Nah. I mean, if I use it against the cops, I'm dead. And I think all the people that hate us and, you know, want to say shit to us are too big of pussies to stop and actually do anything about it, so.
Yeah. Why'd you start carrying?
Well, our roommate got arrested and they stopped letting us march anywhere, so started carrying.
That was a street interview with pro-Black Lives Matter protester and reported Libertarian Party member Garrett Foster just minutes before he was shot to death in an altercation with a motorist during a protest in Austin, Texas. Hello, everyone. A sober Monday to you all. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I know how to pronounce it. I am Matt Welch, joined today by Peter Suderman, yes, but also by two guest stars, Reason Managing Editor Stephanie Slate and Reason TV Producer Zach Weissmuller. Welcome back to the Thunderdome, my good colleagues.
Thanks.
Hi, Matt.
Hi, everyone.
We'll obviously are going to play our game of Matt asks Slate about polling, which we do every time she's on this. That's going to come later. But first,
it's a good game.
It's an excellent game, and she always wins. That's the important thing. I will set up our conversation. We, meaning America, had a bit of a do the right thing weekend in this troubled union of ours. The heat was like a trillion degrees. There were people in the streets, tension high over race-related issues, battles between unruly youths and overarmed law enforcement, and so on. There were riots and violence in Seattle, Portland, Los Angeles, New York, Austin, Oakland, Louisville, Aurora, Colorado, and I presume other places as well. Judging by my blessedly light amount of social media consumption over the weekend, individuals also seem to be kind of like nearing their own personal psychotic breaking points. So before we get into the public policy and such discussions surrounding these events here, I just kind of want to do a quick mental health check. Slade, how are you holding up there in or near the District of Columbia?
Yeah, no, I'm in DuPont in DC. I'm okay. I would say the thing, if there's one sort of overarching theme of probably everything we're going to talk about today, for me, it's that I feel increasingly, though, like I don't know what to think or how to feel or what to say about anything that's happening around me. And so that is not really a comfortable position to be in when you're essentially paid to follow current affairs and then say things about them.
So you have news thorn is what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
Here. Okay, very good. Suderman, you are Slade's neighbor. Sort of, although you're not in DuPont. How are things happening in the McDog household?
They are happening pretty well. The dog is a little bit anxious. He's the most social person in this household, and he's just so depressed all the time, lying around.
Really?
It's so hot. He's, you know, they're English dogs, and they're really big, so they don't like the heat, but also really want to get outside. So he begs me to go outside, and then he's like, it's really hot out here. What are you doing? Why can't you fix that? And then he's upset that he's inside and there's nobody around except me and my wife. However, this weekend I did have two friends over, including Stephanie Slade, for a social distanced drinks. And we smoked
nice.
A 7-pound prime rib
joint
on like a big Komodo, like a big green egg kind of grill thing for a couple of hours. And that was pretty delicious. And we've had exactly one other couple over for the last couple of months and a small number of local family members. So it's not that quite that I have seen no one except the people who live here, but it's pretty close. And it was really great to just see friends and talk with them for a while. Which is something that I haven't done in a long time. And I have to say it was, as like mood improvers go, this was about the best one I've had in a long time.
Human interaction.
And Slade was a big part of that.
I got my first Suder cocktail in 4.5 months. So it was also a good weekend in that sense.
Wow.
Me.
What was it named?
Just a daiquiri.
It was a daiquiri.
But it was a really good daiquiri.
Zach, speaking of social interaction, I have the impression that California has just been locked down since like March 1st or something like that. How are you people dealing with it in a place where like everyone is supposed to spend all their time outside?
Well, that is the key to dealing with it, is just going outside and enjoying the Southern California outdoors. That is the benefit of living here through this very strange time. The drawback is that there are these rules that often are bewildering, like you can go to the beach, but you're not allowed to park at the beach. So you need to walk like three extra blocks to get to the beach and things like this. But it's all because of science, because, you know, Gavin Newsom is a scientist and also a governor, and he's just following the data.
Science so. has like determined the proper distance your car has to be from the beach.
That's right. Yeah, there's so I would just say try to be outside as much as possible. We also were able to invite a kid over today. Our kid is back. My oldest kid is back in preschool now, and kind of seeing him playing with another kid from his school was a nice thing, because they've just been cooped up here, you know. So
did you actually start crying?
The
first time that our 5-year-old got to play with someone, and this is now a good like 6 weeks ago, here in New York, where the pandemic has been mostly tamed by now, but the first time after all that cooping up, it was hard to like contain tears of watching two kids play.
Yeah, I understand that. I was able to hold in the tears, Matt, but
yeah.
You know, it's a straight, like the Corona generation that's growing up now, I think, is going to be permanently affected by this.
They're going to be so much better at Call of Duty than the rest of us.
Yes, they're also going to be really good at washing their hands. It's just like I have a 4-year-old who, you know, counts to 20 every time he's washing his hands, and that's just going to be like a lifelong habit.
So you think. It's amazing how quickly you go from wiping down your groceries to hanging out at bars as the progression goes. Let's get into the policy of this. I want to suggest and we'll talk more about 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds, mm-hmm. especially with Zach later on, because I think there's a lot of interesting policy things associated with that. And that's also associated with the mental sanity of many millions of Americans. But here's a potential frame for the conversation about the altercations in the streets of our cities this past weekend. And it is this: catastrophes, which always eventually happen, are basically like, this is Matt speaking here, are basically like margin calls, right? They show what your exposed positions are. They show what you have not been preparing for. They show underlying dysfunction that maybe wasn't as obvious as it was before, at every possible level of government, state, local, national, of society, of everything. So now the way that this is manifesting is that you have a dysfunctional or semi-functional federal government controlled by Republicans at the moment that is setting in federal law enforcement to dysfunctional or semi-dysfunctional cities controlled mostly, if not exclusively in this case, by Democrats. And everyone is meanwhile releasing their pent-up frustrations on the street. So like, what could go wrong? Suderman, I'm going to turn that into a question. The police chief in Seattle, which featured pretty significant rioting over the weekend, right before the rioting, Carmen Best, said to property owners there, essentially, like, we can't really do much to guard your property against looters and rioters. Sorry, you're on your own. So, you know, to the extent that the cities are going to have police departments, and I know you're not the anarchist among us necessarily, shouldn't that be kind of like one of the things that they do rather than you're on your own, sucka? Isn't that like a hallmark dysfunction that is driving a lot of this conflict?
Yes, these dysfunctions at the local, state, and federal level are feeding on each other and creating feedback loops that make everything worse. And so if you look at the protests and sort of the trajectory of them since very late May when they started through now, They had actually gotten better in most places, which is to say that they had, or at least they had become less destructive, and as well as smaller. And so they'd become manageable, and they'd become less destructive after some pretty destructive nights in late May and early June, even here in Washington, D.C., just a couple of miles from my house. And that had basically stopped. People felt like they were comfortable walking around on city streets in the evenings. And now that is changing. And one of the reasons, not the only reason, but at least one of the reasons that it is changing is that President Trump decided to send federal troops into Portland. And that served as an instigating measure where now you see in other cities, the protesters are not just continuing with their with the protests against racial injustice and police abuse that had started a couple of months ago. They are now adding to that and doing more to protest against the intrusion of federal police into local cities. And the federal police, you know, like I said last week, the Federal Protective Service in particular does have a mandate to protect federal buildings from violence. And there does appear to have been in Portland some destruction of federal property. And that's it's totally legitimate for the Federal Protective Service to take action to stop that. But that is not it's what is going on is much more than that. Is that the Federal Protective Service has brought in these immigration SWAT teams, basically, from CBP and ICE, and then started patrolling a broad area around the courthouse, and not just stopping people from destroying federal property, but basically serving as anti-riot police that are not controlled by the city or coordinating with city cops in any way. And it's really a kind of a recipe for anger, for destruction, for upset, for people, for upheaval, and for making everyone mad on all sides. And again, I don't want to say that this is entirely Trump's fault. People who are engaging in destructive acts have responsibility for their own actions. At the same time, everyone here seems to be behaving pretty badly. There's mismanagement, dysfunction, and frankly, some bad political incentives. Because Trump thinks he's going to run on this in the fall. This is going to be a big part of his election campaign. And because Democratic mayors in some of these cities also have incentives to be far too nice and too accommodating, I think, to some of the protesters who are engaging in violent actions.
Just to as an example of the latter, here in New York City a couple of weeks ago, Mayor Bill de Blasio, who is, I mean, entire books, entire Broadway plays in the future should be written by what an absolute clown he has been exposed to have been all along. Not that we didn't know, but
the worst
man.
Mayor in the nation today, but possibly the worst mayor in like post-war America.
In the middle of all of the things that are associated with the problems in New York, including the most severe, deadly aspect of the pandemic, and troubled relationships with police and the unions and protesters and whatnot, he thought that what we need to do is to commission a Black Lives Matter mural, like out in front of the Trump Tower. Like you. Okay, Zach, so I want to build on kind of Suderman's theory of escalation. Mm-hmm. And since you're a parent, I'm just going to preface everything with this. But like, as a parent, you know about the concept of like escalation and de-escalation, because those are parts of our conversation on a daily basis. I have a 12-year-old girl and a mom in the same house. Okay. So like escalation theory is right on my brain on a constant basis. I'm laughing now and I'm going to pivot to something that is absolutely unfunny, which is the opening clip. It was Garrett Foster, a libertarian party member from what we know of him, brought an AK-47 to a protest. We don't know what happened in the case there, but there was an altercation with an also armed guy in a car. And I think about that. I also think about seeing video that a friend sent of the federal police clearing out the federal courthouse in Portland. And my friend's like, you know what? I don't like cops normally, but I sympathize with this, like, you know, just because those guys are setting fire to the courthouse with people inside every single day. However, in the same video, that cop had a little gun and he's shooting rounds of like a pepper spray. And it's like, if you bring a gun looking device and you start shooting it at people, that is kind of like, by definition, an escalation, an escalatory action. It's going to provoke, you know, walls of moms and people on the street who haven't been there before. So this is a long way of winding up. is it possible that we don't want to de-escalate? Like, people are like, screw it. I want to escalate. Like, there's a market for escalation right now, which troubles me a lot. What say you, Zach Weissmuller?
I completely agree. And I think the person or organization that figures out how to de-escalate is going to be the hero here. I don't know if it's going to happen or if it's possible, but right now it doesn't seem like anyone is even thinking about strategies to get there. And, I think what you brought up about property destruction really is at the center of this question, I think, where nobody likes to see their stuff get graffitied or their windows crashed in or their buildings burned, whether it's a private business owner or a city or the federal government. And to the extent that these police departments and the mayors who are directing them are not making that a central concern, I think that is really exacerbating the situation. I mean, I'm here in LA. There's a perfect example of this back when things were a little more intense in May. There was a protest in Santa Monica, and there's video of the police surrounding these protesters kneeling on the ground. And meanwhile, the mall down the road is getting sacked, ransacked by looters. Like, what is this? And all sides need to start taking this seriously. Anytime you bring up the idea of property destruction, people who are affiliated with the movement, just they downplay it, or they say, they compare it. They say, you know, it's just a Macy's. It's not someone's life. And then the Macy's moves to smaller and smaller stores. And here in LA, the big movement has been downtown, where it's mostly small businesses, immigrant-owned businesses. So we need, I think there just needs to be an ethos, both from the government and within the movement itself, to start trying to police this, both self-police and actually have the police focus on what they're supposed to be doing, which is protecting people's lives and property.
I think it's just useful to say that we can distinguish to some extent a difference between destroying property and bodily harm. The problem is that the destroying property, first of all, it's still wrong. Mm-hmm. And second of all, it very easily bleeds into becoming a bodily harm, right? It's very hard to control a group of people who have decided to burn down or loot a store. And in fact, I'm just going to read you a headline from the New York Times, not from some crazy right-wing website that is making stuff up. A headline from the New York Times just a couple of days ago: police find body in building burned down during George Floyd protests. And this was in a Minneapolis pawn shop. And one of the buildings that, one of the small businesses that they thought they were destroying just to make a point about property without hurting anybody, it looks like the protesters ended up killing someone in the process.
Yeah, it's weird. It's as if you can't control fire during a mob. It's this crazy idea. I saw some people who have once at some point included the word libertarian to describe their proclivities use that as an opportunity to say that property violence isn't violence. Literally, the headline about someone dying through property violence was an opportunity to make a moral stand of differentiation there, which I found to be absolutely nauseating and disgraceful on every level possible. Slade, knowing that you have news thorn in all of this, you can always retreat safely to the soft cocoon of media bias targeting. So I'm going to invite you to comment on this phrase, mostly peaceful. I don't want to turn into Matt Walsh. And if those of you who don't know who Matt Walsh is, it's a person who his name sounds a lot like mine and has different views. Very conservative. I'm not. But Matt Walsh is the type of person who would note and point out, and I presume he already has, that the phrase mostly peaceful was not one that I recall seeing a lot in 2009 in the summer when there was a lot of Tea Party protests. In fact, I recall a lot of people, E.J. Dionne from the Washington Post, for example, talking about like these protests then, which were against Obamacare and increased government spending, were the politics of the jackboot and all of this. When you see the coverage of the way that media is treating these mostly peaceful protests, which have gotten violent in many, 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 many cities on many occasions, do you see this as an example of a media that doesn't understand its own biases?
Yes. And, you know, things have gotten really loopy because I'm about to defend the police a little bit, which is not a thing I normally find myself doing. And to be clear, I'm only referring to local police and not the federal agents that I basically consider to be an occupying force on the streets of U.S. cities right now, and which I find very disturbing. But when it comes to the local police, I think they have not necessarily conducted themselves great in the last 3 months, that there are 2 months that this has all been going on in every case. But they do consider themselves to be putting their lives on the line to try to make their communities better. And a thing that hasn't come up that was related to, I think, directly preceded the Seattle police chief saying, you know, essentially, we're going to be backing off a little bit and not trying to protect businesses, was an attempt by the city government to restrain the police's ability to use certain, what they call, you know, less lethal munitions on protesters. And I think it was an effort on the city's part and the city government's part with the best of intentions, and maybe is the right thing to do and necessary. But from the police's perspective, they're being asked to go into a highly volatile situation every day and every night where they don't know what's going to happen. In some of these cities, as we saw this weekend, the protesters are armed. So there have been violence. For the most part, it's mostly been property destruction and not violence against people, but the police are trained to expect the worst. And rather than thoughtfully thinking about how do we reform our policing and how do we reform these systems process-wise, you know, and implement better systems and better training and replace some duties of police with other, you know, other service providers or whatever, just in the middle of this conflagration, for a city to say, we're going to take away some of the tools that you think are necessary to do your job, is not a thing. I actually sympathize with the police who say, well, then we're not going to be able to do our jobs as well, and we're not going to try to do some of the things that, you know, what you're asking us, if from our perspective, it feels like you're asking us to risk our lives for your building, and you're not giving us the tools that we feel like we would need to do that safely, then we're going to do less of that thing. And again, I can't believe that I'm essentially siding with the police. I have very strongly been on the side of the protesters throughout all of this, and I still am. I mean, I still think that reforms are absolutely necessary. We're crying out for reform. And in fact, next month's issue of Reason Magazine will be a sort of reform and solutions-oriented take on what can we actually do to fix policing in this country. But I think the answer is usually not like hastily thrown together, you know, prohibitions on what police can or can't do in the midst of a crisis situation where they feel like they are being targeted and their lives are on the line. That just doesn't seem like it is the right way to go about fixing this problem. I don't know, maybe there isn't a better. I keep coming back to, like, I don't know what the right answer is in the near term. I have lots of thoughts about long-term, you know, again, ways to fix policing. Short-term, in the middle of a sort of crisis moment, what we do, how we maximize or how we create the sort of optimal outcome of this very, very difficult situation, I do not know. But I think that we maybe need to be a little more, I don't know, a little more sensitive to the perspective of the law enforcement, again, local law enforcement as well in these situations. Because for the most part, I think they're trying to do the right thing. And I, friend of Reason, Jonathan Blanks, shared an article last night about from the sort of perspective of police in Huntsville, Alabama, and how increasingly they're just sent out on these mental health calls, and they're sent into apartments where people are off their psychotic drugs, and they are armed, and they are putting their family members, there's some small children in danger, and the police have to go in, and they haven't been trained for this. And every single time it is, you know, there's a sense of, am I going to get killed? Is my career going to be over because I have to kill somebody? You know, and this is a really, really high stretch. This is not an easily solvable situation.
Couple of follow-on points to that. One is that in Portland, Oregon, the mayor there, Ted Wheeler, as has been reported out by Nancy Rommelman, who did a bang-up job of covering Portland for Reason.com this past week, one of the things that led up to this is that the mayor's basically said, you know what, we're going to let we're going to let the protesters, you know, kind of like work it out of their system for the last 3 years. So like they've learned a set of habits from that, that has something to it. Another point, which might sound contradictory, but it's just out there, is that in places where policing is particularly bad or that has had particularly either bad relations with the community and or kind of powers that they've grown used to that are being taken away from them, you can have petulant, you know, equivalents of sit down strikes. Oh, you're not going to let us, you know, cover for our union members? Screw you. I'm not going to do anything about the looters. That can happen too. That's been kind of looked at through when people have studied the so-called Ferguson effect from 2014. It's the bad police departments, especially, who react badly and sitting on their hands in those positions. I want to shift a little bit to what's going to be news this week. And Aaron, Elizabeth Nolan Brown. I have nieces named Aaron and Elizabeth. So just, you know, bear with me. Elizabeth Nolan Brown wrote about this morning for a reason is that there's talk about the new CARES Act, the We Care Harder Act stimulus coming from Capitol Hill. And right now appears to be that the gap is between Republicans who want to spend another $1 trillion on top of the, I think, 3.5 to 4 that we've already sent out there, depending on how you measure it, and Democrats who want $3 trillion. So I'm putting the early betting on the $2 trillion mark. Peter, I know you've read all of both of proposals in their entirety. It goes without saying, probably they haven't been written and no one's been actually making proposals. However, I want to like look at this through the lens of testing, right? Which is to say, like, my wife took a test recently, or I shouldn't say that. Somebody I know took a test recently. It took like 8 days to get your results. Like, testing is taking longer than ever. We've had 5 months of figuring out what to do about this. And part of what the figuring out to do nationally or otherwise is like, let's get quick turnarounds on tests. What the hell, Peter? Why are we talking $1 trillion anything when tests can't get done in anything like a timely fashion? Is it your fault?
Probably it is my fault. What's amazing, Just as a starting bid here, is that one of the points of contentions within the Republican Party about their own package is that the White House doesn't want to spend more money on testing. And this has been like a point that pro-Trump people have been making sometimes on Twitter is like, wait, the media's got this testing story all wrong. We've had a half a trillion, billion, zillion tests since April, and actually the testing is online. And it is true that the number of tests is pretty large. We have actually gotten to the point where people who want to get tests can, in most cases, get tested. What they cannot do is get the results of their test. And it's a huge problem. The turnaround time has actually gotten worse in a lot of places. And the companies doing this are, you know, say, well, look, we are experiencing unprecedented demand, which is true. And it's hard to figure out where the demand hotspots will be, because even if you can figure out where the hotspots for viral outbreak will be, sometimes there is also huge demand in places that are not hotspots for viral outbreak, but are just trying to reopen. And so a lot of people want to get tested before they go out and do stuff. And so it's places that where there's, you know, they're not red zones on our contagion map. A big part of the problem goes back to, as we talked about several times on this podcast, but last week, the initial failure of the CDC and the FDA. They spent 2 months that were really important not getting testing up and rolling. And so, yes, we have gotten testing capacity, again, in terms of getting the test in the first place. It is pretty good at this point. We have not quite caught up, but it has gotten much, much better. However, we just have this backlog when everything gets sent, gets to the labs. And so what we have are tests that need to tell you whether you are sick today, and you get the results if you are lucky in 3 or 4 days in a lot of places. And in many cases, we are seeing reports of turnaround times as long as 16, 17 days. It's completely useless at that point. It provides no value to the person who has gotten tested. And even a week is far too long a turnaround time. You really need to get these in 2, no more than 3 days in order for them to be actionable, because you don't, in most cases, go get tested until you're starting to show symptoms. But you are you can spread the virus for days prior to showing symptoms. And so even by the time you are getting yourself tested, you are deep into the sort of into being contagious. And it's a huge problem for individuals trying to manage their own risks. It's a huge problem for businesses and sort of local authorities trying to figure out reopening. It's a huge problem for the country that we just don't have visibility on this. And again, it's not just that it goes back to the CDC and FDA's historical screw-ups. It's that there is a continuing screw up, which is that the FDA appears to be blocking rapid paper strip tests that you can do at home that take about 15 minutes. And the reason they're blocking them is that they are not as accurate as the PCR swab tests that you get where they stick a giant Q-tip up your nose and then tell you if you have the virus 2 weeks later. Now, it is true. Those strip tests, not as accurate. They're going to be wrong more often, less reliable than those swab tests. But if you have a test that is, say, 50 or 60% or 70% accurate, and you can take it every day for $10 or for $5, it makes much more sense to be doing that every single day and just getting a rolling reading on yourself than waiting till you have symptoms and then getting a test that may not come for a week or 2 weeks. And the FDA is prohibiting this because they want really highly accurate tests rather than tests that are actually useful.
One of the most common ways that this is going to be used, especially in the month of August, is that people are going to want to use this before they send their kids to and while they send their kids to school, especially kids who are of elementary school age and even younger. You kind of want to know if you're sending your health spawn into a viral zone or if the teachers at the school are getting the infection, although there's very, very little evidence to the extent that we've been surveying this throughout the world of any cases, really, of kids, elementary age kids, infecting their caregivers, their teachers, and so on. Zach, you just mentioned that you sent your kid back to preschool. Talk a little bit about your own and senses of whether you think schools should be open full time. I believe that they should very strongly, but then again, I'm in a different place virally than you are, and just sort of the debate as you see it playing out in Southern California, a place where teachers' unions have had, you know, strong sway, but there's also been a charter school movement. What does it look like to you, the school reopening question, against the backdrop of crappy testing?
Yeah, my kids' preschool, it's a small private school, and so it's been fairly easy for them to just do temperature checks and keep the kids, you know, relative as socially distanced, I guess, as you can keep kids. They even wear masks, as long as they'll tolerate it. It's a strange situation, to be sure. In terms of the public schools, the elementary schools, I've been talking to a lot of parents, and I'm working on a video piece about this because California is making it pretty much impossible for parents to do anything in the fall. Like, the teachers union has here in LA successfully lobbied to, you know, prevent any opening whatsoever. The schools will not be opening in LA and in most California counties, actually. And the issue is the teachers union put out a study saying they needed, you know, about $250 million in additional funding, and also a moratorium on new charter schools, and
that's
also
very important.
Defunding.
Right,
all,
we wouldn't want more classrooms in a right. world where the biggest issue is like for health is keeping people physically separated from each other.
Right, and also, by the way, during the spring when they were shut down, they also managed to get a situation where they are required to work 4 hours a day, and they're not required to do virtual instruction. And so they basically are sending packets out, and then you can maybe arrange a Skype call with your teacher at some point during the week. So what a lot of parents are trying to do is find virtual learning alternatives, or you've heard about the emergence of these micro schools and pods, and they're also actively working to quash that. The budget just went through that says that new virtual charter schools, which are set up specifically for this situation, are allowed to take newly enrolled students, but they're not allowed to get any additional funding. The funding, you know, per student funding is capped at last year's budget. It's just frozen in place. And so we have this unprecedented dynamic situation where everyone is trying to find some way to get their kids taken care of, maybe even educated a little bit in the upcoming year. And every solution is just being blocked off at the pass.
Has any Democratic governor or mayor of a big city offered a solution? Like said, here, parents, not just let's not just said, here are the things you can't do. Here's what we're going to do in terms of capping funding or keeping funding. Here's what we're going to do to protect our teachers' unions. Have any of them said, look, parents, we understand you're in a difficult position. Here are some sort of forward thinking options. Here are things you can do. Because it looks to me like none of them are saying anything like that. They are all saying, here are all the things you can't do. And even amongst the things you can still technically do, you should feel really bad about them.
So in New York, for example, Bill de Blasio, while saying that schools will only be open 1 to 3 days a week, and that includes elementary schools. And again, kids between the ages of 5 and 14, there have been 16 deaths period on coronavirus. You're three times as likely to die from the flu, five times as pneumonia or vice versa on those two numbers. But like it's people are not dying. And also, again, people are not infecting. Kids that age are not infecting adults. It's not happening. So like the baseline safety question is pretty well established at this point. Anyways, Bill de Blasio says, no, we're not going to do anything more than 1 to 3 days a week. And also, we're not going to make a final decision until September, which is a hell of a way to plan things out when you're a parent.
When do schools normally open in New York?
September, but the date isn't even fixed now. Usually we know what the date is and we don't know what the date is. But here's his to answer your question, Peter. He said, well, what we're going to do is offer a city-run daycare in for 100,000 families. Granted, there's for 100,000 kids, and there are 1.1 million kids in the school system, and so they're going to look for spaces like underused facilities in which they can do
like schools.
I'm not making this up. This is what Bill de Blasio. You know what they do? Yeah, I probably mentioned this before, and if so, I'm sorry for shouting. But they close all the parks around town, including the one right next to my house that is a big open space with nothing in it. And they closed it down, couldn't go in for months. And so they opened up streets so that kids could play, including right next to that park. Jesus. Okay. I'm going to get a hold of myself. Yes.
Yeah, no, I was also just going to say with this whole micro schooling and home-based pod trend is very real. These Facebook groups are emerging everywhere where parents are spontaneously organizing, you know, let's all get together and hire a teacher. You know, there's no, and we'll do it in our backyard and we'll rotate around people's different backyards. People are coming up with creative solutions. And I think that they're creative solutions that could potentially last well beyond coronavirus if they work out well. And even this kind of desperate move is being met with articles guilting people, saying, you know, well, not everyone's going to be able to do micro schools, which is a legitimate point. But the answer to that is what some states have done following what Betsy DeVos has suggested, which is to redirect funds into the hands of parents so that they can get together and hire a teacher and make something happen. And so it just feels like every solution is being quashed and headed off at the pass. And it's all about making people feel bad for trying to figure it out.
Can I just stop and say that we are seeing, like, it's worth remarking on this, because what we have seen in the last, I think, 6 months is just a massive state failure at nearly every level. The government has just failed all of us in almost every way. The federal government, state governments, local governments, the police, schools, the healthcare system, all of it had a job to do. And then when a crisis came, the job didn't get done. And to the extent that these jobs are being done, they are being done by the private sector. So if you go back and look at April, when everything was shut down in the United States, the grocery stores and Amazon and the delivery services, they weren't perfect. They were under a huge amount of strain, but they stepped up and delivered. The internet, the social media, the sort of all of these private sector things that we have to keep us connected, that was what worked. It didn't work perfectly. I don't love Zoom, right? Like, it's not an ideal solution, but it's a lot better than any of the alternatives that the government offered us. Yeah. And now what we're seeing with schools is that people are figuring out how to do stuff on their own, imperfectly, in a distributed way. It's not the same for everyone. Not everyone is going to come up with as good a solution as everyone else. Not everyone is going to have access to as good solutions. But what the government is doing is getting in the way of people figuring out solutions for themselves. And this is just, there's just been a kind of like a layer cake of failure where, you know, if you like drill down through the earthly, like if you've ever seen those like earth cores that they take out to like look at sediment layers, right? Like at each sediment layer of governments down all the way down, everything has failed. And it is just a remarkable case study in systemic state dysfunction that I don't think I have ever seen, certainly at this intensity or at this scale in my lifetime.
Yeah, it's been a wake-up call. For a lot of people, I think I didn't, you know, I've been a skeptic of state power for a long time, but I didn't realize how incompetent our various levels of government actually are. And especially, you know, we're in this weird no man's land where we're not like, I guess, you know, you look at some of the responses in some of these small Southeast Asian countries, Singapore and so forth, where they have a more authoritarian approach, but at least it's competent. And then our advantage is supposed to be that we have a more, I guess, libertarian approach, but we don't even have that. We have these giant agencies that are trying to intervene and doing a poor job at it. So we're getting just like the worst of both worlds. And it's been I don't know, it's made me look at government in new ways.
One thing that's interesting in all of this is that, you know, as we kind of talked about at the top, it's a hot rage boiling summer. And you think if it's rage boiling now, imagine the millions of American parents of school age children come September are going to be, it's because we already went through spring. We know what it's like. We can't have it again. It's going to be bad. There's going to be, talk about like a Brooks Brothers riot. There's going to be a Target riot. But yet through all of this, on the headline political race of the day, which is President Trump versus Joe Biden, the polls anyways, you see that's a transition? Who saw that transition? The polls anyway have been kind of remarkably stable, just kind of inching ever more towards Biden. He's up by around 8 percentage points. He's been up by at least since 4 four more, just kind of steadily increasing since March. He's up consistently in a bunch of states that voted Trump last time, including Arizona, Florida, Minnesota, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, North Carolina. Slade, as teased, you are the person who cautions to stop reading polls or don't read polls too prematurely. Can we read polls yet? Are we allowed to? And if so, what A, can we learn from them? And B, do we get from the sort of seeming stability of them at a time when everything else in American life feels so unstable?
You can look at the polls and we can draw some conclusions from them. I think that that's fair. What I'd caution against is drawing conclusions about like, well, the election's over. Biden's got it won. It's over for Trump. I mean, that's in order to come to that conclusion, you would have to not only assume that the polls are methodologically sound, and to include accurately distinguishing between just like regular voter, registered voters and likely voters, actual voters, and that nothing in the ambient environment is going to dramatically change in the next 100 days. And to me, to make that second assumption would require such an incredible failure of imagination, given how much has changed in the last 100 days, and how we have watched the world just like collapse around us in the last 6 months. And we just don't know what's coming. And like, it could be things that are inconceivable to us right now. And there are some things that are not so inconceivable. God forbid, Joe Biden could die. I mean, there could be a terrorist attack on this country. Like, we just don't know what's going to happen. And so the idea that, like, well, this unusually persistent polling lead that Biden has had now for weeks at a time really, you know, precludes the possibility of anything changing. Like, no, please do not fall into that trap. What polls do, what they can do, is give us a sort of pulse check on the country. Where is the country right now? Where has it been and where is it right now? One thing I would say about that, though, is if you're just trying to get a sense of where the country is, then actually registered voter polls are going to be better than likely voter polls. Trying to add some sort of likely voter filter to your poll is going to introduce more potential for error. Because if what we want to know is where is the country right now, we can easily weight our data to reflect the country as a whole or the demographic characteristics of the entire registered voter population. But anytime you're talking about likely voters, anytime you're trying to actually predict the outcome of an election, you have to make assumptions, guesses, about who's going to turn out on election day. And those are always subject to being very, very wrong. I mean, we were very wrong in 2012. We thought that the sort of young and African-American Obama voters who surged to the polls in 2008 would not repeat the defeat, and we were wrong. You know, we were wrong about who was going to turn out in 2016. And so we can guess, we can make educated guesses, but we don't know who's going to turn out on election day. And so actually, I think you're on more solid ground this far out by looking at the larger population of everybody in the country. Where do they?
And just to interject, would you recommend that in September and October as well? Or is there a calendar switch on LV versus RV?
Well, you do. Okay. The sort of best practice generally is that you move from registered voters to likely voters as you get closer to the election. But keep in mind, everything is so screwed up this year. Like, we don't have a running mate for one of the candidates yet. Usually the polls start to react to things like the announcement of the challenger's running mate, the actual speeches given at the nominating conventions, which are not, I mean, the speeches I guess will happen, but the conventions aren't going to happen, that's for sure. You know, like,
Scott Bio is going to give a speech at the GOP convention.
I'm sure that will really create a polling bump.
Bayo.
But so like, people start to tune in as things happen in the race. Oh, the debates, of course, would be another example. People start to tune in when you start to have the big debates between the two candidates. They start to form opinions. They start to harden their opinions. They start to decide whether they are motivated enough to go to the polls, and you can start. But so, like, none of that stuff has happened yet. So trying to guess at not just measure the current attitudes correctly, but guess at how they're going to change over time is, I think, a fool's errand.
Thank you for that. Let's pivot to our end of show, what you have been consuming on a cultural level. I'm going to go first this time, just because I have a feeling that Suderman might chirp in. So I have been with my 12-year-old, decided to take a summer of marching through chronologically, as in the chronology of the movies and television series, through the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yes.
Oh, God. And I start as...
Which was her favorite coronavirus stimulus bill, since they're the same? Remember
right.
How we did that?
Wow.
That's a whole metaphor?
Deep cut. And I usually I just blank out when you start talking about the MCU. So maybe that's why I don't remember it. So anyways, I go in there as someone who's not necessarily a fan, but I'm sort of appreciative of it. And I'd seen maybe half or slightly less of the movies, most of the last ones, not the early ones. So we're marching through the early ones. And the one that I will talk about just now is Iron Man 2, which came out in 2010. Just saw the other day. And I read these not as a huge comic book fan, although I did like the Avengers in the 1980s. That's one of the only ones I ever read. But as someone who kind of appreciates the way that these movies are, they remind me of the Irwin Allen disaster films of the 1970s, which is like, it kind of didn't matter what happened, a lot of crash and bang, but you'll watch Steve McQueen do anything. You'll watch Shelley Winters or whoever else is, you know, Gene Hackman, like, bring it on. I will watch them do anything. Just sort of this star power, almost Rat Packy, like shiny thing. I'm very impressed how many phenomenal actors get just bit roles in MCU movies. So Iron Man 2, and also a weird way of looking at Iron Man 2 is that it's, if you recall, for the first Iron Man, it was definitely an aughts picture. It starts in Afghanistan in a cave. There's waterboarding. Like, you feel the ghost of Dick Cheney hovering over the proceedings. Iron Man 2 is still, which is 2010, is still like early aughts. Robert Downey has an aughts haircut. Elon Musk is there for some reason. That's completely baffling. So it's interesting to watch those movies through a different kind of filter. Scarlett Johansson makes her first appearance and it's tremendous. And Sam Rockwell's in there dancing around. So all great, super fun, and totally appreciate their formula, even if none of their movies are nearly as good as the best of the ones from the DC universe. Suderman, are you going to zip it
I actually just need to say a couple of things. Iron Man 2 is the most libertarian of the MCU films. It features a hero who is an ex-defense contractor who has given up on building on being a defense contractor, and then the defense contractor in the movie is the bad guy, and Tony Stark, our hero, unironically, I mean, kind of ironically, because he's Robert Downey Jr. and everything he says has a sort of ironic tinge to it. But he says to a bunch of senators who are trying to basically tell him what he has to do with his business, he says, "You want my property? You can't have it. But I did you a favor. I privatized world peace." Like,
it's true.
That is, I think, several Reason Magazine cover stories from the 1980s. Also, the entire MCU got started because... And like was successful because they took a chance on Robert Downey Jr., an ex-con who was having trouble getting work. And the MCU is a parable about the value of forgiveness and how people can come back and be rehabilitated and do great things for the world.
That was beautiful.
That is beautiful. Slade, what have you been consuming culturally speaking?
I am reading a relatively new book by scholar Robert Riley called America on Trial, A Defense of the Founding, which I think you might think or assume he's a conservative scholar, would be a response to the sort of 1619 Project idea that the American founding is rooted in slavery and the original evil, and, you know, there's nothing sort of worth salvaging there. But actually, it's much more a response to the critics of the sort of classical liberal founding ideals on the right. So people like Notre Dame's Patrick Deneen, Yoram Hazani, and these guys on the right who say, essentially, America was founded on libertarian principles of individual autonomy and freedom, and they're rooted to the core, and we're reaping the, you know, the fruits of that today with the sort of, you know, horrifying malaise in the country and the collapse of our civil society institutions and, you know, all of that. So it's sort of a response from the right to the people on the right who are critics of the American founding, which I think is quite a useful, actually, project.
Awesome. Zach, what have you been gobbling up?
I've started watching a Australian series called Stateless that you can access on Netflix. It's inspired by the true events of an Australian citizen who ends up detained in an immigration center for complicated reasons. And it's really worth watching because Australia is like this uncanny version of America. So there's enough familiarity, but enough psychological and political distance to view the immigration issue in a different light and really let yourself get immersed in the lives and the drama of the detainees and get a visceral understanding of what's at stake for people who are making these insanely perilous journeys across oceans, and also just what it's like to be endlessly stuck in the bureaucratic machinery, just waiting for your application to get processed, and also the workers and bureaucrats who are part of that machinery when it's become the focus of so much political heat there as it has here. I mean, there's like news helicopter that's regularly circling over the detention center, filming people on the roof holding signs. And in general, I mean, this is what I really appreciate about the age of streaming is the easy access to these shows that we otherwise wouldn't see that are made in other countries. There's another great one that I watched called 1983. It's a Polish dystopian show. So yeah, Stateless is really great. I recommend it.
I feeling some nostalgia for immigration. That was fun when we used to have that. Suderman, take us home. What have you been consuming?
I have been listening to the new Taylor Swift album, the secret Taylor Swift album, Folklore, that she recorded during lockdown. I am not usually a big Taylor Swift fan, not a hater. I think she's quite talented, but it's just not for me. But I was particularly interested in this album because 11 of the 16 songs were co-written with Aaron Dessner, the main songwriter and guitarist of The National. And The National is like the prototypical kind of monotone, indie sad dad rock band, right? They're just sort of like, they're not ironic necessarily, but they're super distanced and like emotionally disengaged, even when they're singing about like the saddest middle-aged man stuff. And it's an incredible contrast to Taylor Swift, who's this like hyper emotionally engaged, very sort of simple, direct, but like earnestly and honestly felt singer who tells these little compact stories. She's like her real strength as a lyricist is just in narrative. And somehow or another, I think it's good. And like, I think I even like it. I started listening to it and I was like, it sort of felt like a joke, right? Like, what if you had, you know, a mashup between The National and Taylor Swift? And you're like, what even is that? But somehow or another, in lockdown, Taylor Swift has made a very Taylor Swiftian sad dad mope rock album that turns out to be, I don't know, just what I needed.
That is all the sad dad mope rocking we have time for here on the Reason Roundtable. Thank you to Stephanie Slade and Zach Weissmuller for showing. I'm sorry I do that, Zach. It's a running joke in my family. Anytime there's a German sounding name, we contort our faces and have fun with it. And I can't stop it. But anyways, thank you to both. And one or the both of you will be coming back soon, I think, because Catherine Mangu Ward is out hiking the Appalachian Trail. And I don't know exactly where Nick is having his peyote marathons, but it's not anywhere near civilization. So again, thank you. And thank you all for listening. Continue to listen to all things located at reason.com podcasts, including the Wednesday interview with Nick Gillespie and the Soho Forum with Gene Epstein and other luminaries. Again, thanks and goodbye.